that's my favorite guy on the Hammond B3 organ, Jimmy Smith, with a little number called The Sermon. It's only 20 minutes long. When he starts playing, he doesn't like to stop. A wonderful, wonderful tune. And I thought I would share that with you. It's really one of my very, very favorite pieces of music and one of my very favorite musicians, Jimmy Smith, with The Sermon. By the way, he's on organ, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Tina Brooks on tenor sax, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we pick up from where we left off with each other just yesterday. And up until yesterday, we were looking and listening carefully at this trial that is going on in Brunswick, Georgia, where three men are charged with chasing down and killing 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery as he went jogging on February the 23rd, 2020, through a white community near where he lived. As a second week of the controversial trial proceeds, we at Lead Stories should continue our discussion on major developments in the case and what they might be telling us, what might be the instructions from those telling pieces of information that have been shared so far about what the outcome of this trial might be. It's a very significant trial. We had flare-ups, people being very upset, lawyers for the defendants, very upset about the presence in the courtroom of what were termed as black preachers. They don't like black preachers in the courtroom because they are an intimidating force, and they wanted the judge to ban black preachers. Well, the judge said, forget it. And so many in the black community who are affiliated with churches and with faith movements continue to attend this trial and maintaining a presence with the family. That was the most important thing. To not just attend. This is not, you know, a Hollywood glamour moment. It is about supporting the family in their time of grief and, of course, making the statement to the world that they are not alone in their grief, and people are concerned about them, especially in the black community. So that was the drama, the ongoing drama, this fight over the black preachers. We don't want black preachers. They objected and talked specifically about Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, which really shows that these folks don't know very much about the black community. I would be surprised if nobody in the black church would be present at a time like this during a trial. This is just the black community doing its thing. It is not going to leave the family all by itself, thinking that, well, they're in this alone. Not at all. And their very presence, if their presence is so threatening, could you imagine what would happen if people really turned out? It's just the ministers and their men of faith And that's what they feel compelled to do, not for themselves alone, but for the whole black community, showing support at a time of great distress. So we're going to continue our conversation because things are happening in this courtroom that eventually will affect the outcome of this trial. And I wanted to know from you, because you're important. You're important too. What it means, what this trial means as you follow it to the extent that you can. What do you glean from it? What are the messages being sent, and why are they being sent, both positive and negative? And to what degree will actions affect the eventual outcome of this case? So we go directly to the phones at 888-874-4888. Let's be clear about something. We are not debating the case. That's happening in the court. But we are making notations about significant developments in this case to you and to me, and what those developments portend for the eventual outcome of this case, how this case will end. You should have a lot of thinking to do about that, and you should have a lot to say about what you are observing in real time via television, of course. But what is going on? What is this case? What will it eventually come to mean? We know what in the immediate aftermath it means, but eventually, as time passes, what do you expect this case will come to mean? All right. Don't wait, because what happens is we get a log jam and many people are excluded from the discussion because they're too late. And we miss their input and we have to wait for it. You have an idea, you have a contribution to make, do it as quickly as you can. It speeds up the efficiency of time for us. 888-874-4888. What do you consider to be some of the most significant developments in this case so far? And how would those developments, or that particular development that you're concentrating on, how might that affect the outcome of the case? 888-874-4888. We're not wasting time. We're taking calls as soon as they come in. All right, we're waiting to see who is number one, and that's Henry from Chicago. Hello, Henry. You're on the air.
Hey, you, Treece. How's it going?
It's going. How's by you?
Yeah, it's going over here, too. Now, is there anything specific you wanted to talk about with this Ahmaud Arbery case, or?
No, you have to tell us what you see as being significant, a significant development in this case. Why is it significant to you, and what do you think will come of that, which you are telling us today? How might it factor in to the end of this case?
Well, I think with this case, it's important because of the fact that, and you have to look at it, you know, and I think you and many people agree with me, you got to look at this through a racial lens. And it's important because of the fact that this is kind of a litmus test of, are white people allowed to, you know, justifiably, as they call it, murder black people, and in particular, unarmed, you know, black males. Now, I would say this is kind of like the George Zimmerman case that happened a couple of years ago, with the exception that in the Zimmerman murdering Trayvon Martin, there was no video presented. Now, there's video in this case. So what we're going to see is how far the courts will go to say, well, you know, this looks obvious, but because of the fact that, you know, these quote-unquote good white people try to defend themselves from this suspicious black man, let's see how far the vigilante justice of white people can go. And let's see what the reaction of the public will be. Now, for me, I think what's going to happen is I believe that these men will get charged, but it will not be to the extent of, you know, a murder. I think they'll probably get charged with maybe, you know, some lesser crime and, you know, be out in, you know, maybe three to five years, just so they can appease, you know, the public's sentiment, because obviously a lot of eyes are on this case, as well as some of the other cases that are happening right now. But this is a litmus test of to see how far white vigilante murder can go in a modern day justice or injustice system, as I like to call it.
So, if the case begins to come to an end soon, what are you looking for? I mean, what are going to be some of your telltale signs that it is headed in a particular direction?
Well, you know, like I said, obviously the ruling, you know, what's going to happen, you know, or what will be the outcome of it? Will these people get charged? And then also
they are charged. They are facing serious charges.
Oh yeah. Well, so what I meant was the verdict. What will the verdict be? With these white men, and then what is the extent of the sentencing? If they are charged, I still hold.
Okay, that pertains specifically to the case. What are you expecting the reverberations of such a decision to be?
Well, I may have expressed it a few minutes ago, where
yes,
this will be, you know, this will be a test to see how far white men can extend vigilante justice to, you know, to people, and especially black people. And if it's not that bad, you know, as it's measured, you know, they could say, well, you know, I'm not going to get as much time, you know, killing certain people in the name of self-defense. And what's also important about this case, too, is this deals with non-law enforcement people. So, like, correct me if I'm wrong, none of them were current law enforcement people. I know one of them was a former cop, right?
Yes.
Okay, so, yeah, this deals with non-law enforcement people. So this actually is not, you know, they can't go behind when the cops shoot unarmed people, something immunity. Why am I having a brain fart right now? but you know what I'm talking about, Utrecht.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not behind that particular immunity that police have. So this is citizen on citizen type of, you know, violence when it comes to the legality of it. But we all know the aspect of this case in a racial lens and what it implicates to to white people who can, you know, possibly either get minimum sentencing or can get away with stuff like this.
All right. Well, you made quite a few notations, and they're all very important. We'll see how things go. Thanks so much for getting us started.
Qualified immunity, that's what I meant.
The what?
Qualified immunity, that's the name.
Qualified immunity.
Yes. All right, thanks.
The brain kicked in after all.
Yes.
Thanks a lot for getting us started today. Ed from Queens, you're on the air at 888-874-4888. What have you noticed and what have you regarded as significant developments in this case so far? And what do you think the impact or repercussions might be of those things that you have noted?
Well, good afternoon, by the way. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm okay. I'm hanging in.
You and me both. After after the show yesterday, the last exchange you had with the caller prompted me to look into the question of citizen's arrest, because I believe this is, from a legal aspect, the fulcrum of this case. The defense is alleging that these men were authorized to make, quote unquote, a citizen's arrest. Citizen's arrest is more of a legal factuality than I thought it was. And I've done my research. I've read some articles about it, some laws pertaining to it. In that part of Georgia, there is a citizen's arrest statute. And it roughly states that you can stop someone in the process of committing a crime. Number one, if you see it, physically, you see it, the crime, like a snatching a purse, for example, or breaking into a home, and you physically know a crime is being committed, you can activate this citizen's arrest component of the law. Or if you have what they call, quote unquote, credible knowledge. If someone comes to you and says, listen, that guy robbed me, can you help me stop him? And there are criteria with that. You're allowed to detain that person for an hour. Within that hour, you must call the police. Or if you're in the process of physically detaining that person, if the proper authorities don't arrive on the scene within an hour, you have to let that person go, unless that person is threatening you, threatening of property, or threatening the or threatening someone else. You have to let that person go. You're not allowed to use deadly force. But this law is vague, and it was also overhauled after the Ahmaud Arbery killing. That being said, what I believe is going to happen with this case is going to boil down to the minutia on how the judge and how the jury interpret that law, how familiar they are with that law, similar to the stand your ground ruling that saved George Zimmerman, in my opinion. It's going to boil down to, from a legal aspect, how that law works, because I don't think that the prosecution or the defense, for that matter, are going to make race a component. My opinion is they should, because I believe personally in my heart the justification that these men are using was the race of Ahmaud Arbery, insofar as race being a construct. But I believe that how the jury and how the prosecution and how the defense present this law in aspect to these men's actions will be the deciding factor of this case legally. Nationally,
well, we do have testimony in this trial from a police officer who responded, one of the first people to respond, who testified that I don't remember whether it's the father or the son. It was the son.
He questioned the son. Yeah, it was the son. After the shooting, they were standing over Ahmaud Arbery's body, and they questioned the son. And the son stated that he wasn't aware of actually seeing Ahmaud take anything from the site. But the law allows
Not only that. He actually said that he was acting upon a feeling about Ahmaud. He was acting upon a suspicion about Ahmad. And then the next question should be, what is this suspicion? Do you have a list depending on people's races or whatever as to what do you expect them to do or don't expect them to do? That's a huge problem.
Yes.
When he says he acted, including, of course, mentioning this killing, that he was acting upon his own instinct about Ahmad.
But you see, that's why the governor, I believe personally, that's why the governor of that part of Georgia overhauled the law after the killing. Because prior to the killing, those statutes were vague. And that's the problem with citizens' arrest statutes. They vary from state to state, and they're very vague as to what entitles you to take action, and number two, what you can do after action. In Georgia, the initial iteration of the law was very vague. Yes, you can witness somebody's crime or reasonable knowledge. Reasonable knowledge. What is reasonable knowledge? I went on an instinct. Someone told me that this person committed a crime, and I involved myself in pursuit. That reasonable knowledge was a vague statute. They tried to clarify it, but the first iteration of the law is what they'll have to go under because the killing took place. The law was amended after the killing took place. So now, how is that reasonable assumption going to be determined? That's my question.
Well, also, the problem here with that argument is there was no benefit given to Ahmad to defend himself. He wasn't.
He doesn't have to be.
He wasn't asked anything.
Yeah, but under this citizen's arrest,
Shooter was operating on instinct.
Yes,
he didn't conduct an interview, and even so, even if he did conduct an interview, he took lethal summary action based strictly on what he characterized as his feeling, his instinct about Ahmad.
Yes, but unfortunately, the way the law is written, it allows you that leeway. These laws are very vague, and they differ from state to state. You understand?
They
have different iterations, huh?
Yes, but we saw what we saw. Let's say we go with the citizen's arrest argument.
Mm-hmm.
There was no back and forth in accusing the Ahmad of anything and giving him an opportunity to respond. They just pulled out the shotgun, shot him three times. The other one had a 357 Magnum. Yes. So they were not particularly interested in conversation. And nobody called the cops.
That's my point. They violated the tenets of the citizens arrest law in that part of Georgia because, number one, upon detaining the individual, you have to call the police, and you're allotted a 90-minute time limit to detain the individual. You cannot use any type of force, be it lethal or non-lethal, if this individual wants to leave. The law, the statute, doesn't allow you to use any type of force unless the individual is threatening you, the individual is threatening another person, or the individual is threatening property. You understand what I'm saying? These laws, it goes back to the Zimmerman case. Stand your ground. All of these state statutes are BS. We have to have a national, we have to have a national standard specifically pertaining to these type of stand your ground citizens arrest laws that clarifies the parameters of citizens' responsibility and right action in these cases. Until we have
both the father and the son were familiar with police procedure.
Yes.
And police procedure, at the very least, they would ask you a couple of questions.
Yeah, they but they didn't tell about
that. Well, you need to be shot right now, and we're going to do it.
That's Well, they didn't care about that. They weren't operating within the parameters of even the civilian's arrest statute that was on the books in Georgia. Same like Zimmerman. Same like other cases that we've had where people take the law into their own hands. There needs to be a national standard for this, to stop this, because every individual case we're going to wind up adjudicating, was this person justified? Did this person have a legal responsibility or legal justification for their actions, whatever their actions are? There's no national standard.
Do you have a response?
It's a state-by-state business.
Do you have a response to this question? Yes. I dispute this whole notion of the citizen's arrest. I think that was a blanket denial of that across the nation. But okay, we'll get into that a little bit deeper when people familiar with the law, the so-called law, can instruct us in what exactly is a citizen's arrest. But what do you say about the correlation between people who exercise this so-called right of citizen's arrest and race?
Well, they're part and parcel together. The reason why these laws came into effect was because of slavery, of the abolition of slavery, of different freed states. All of these laws tie into the Dred Scott decision. They tie into the police. That's what I'm saying. We need to nationalize, just like we had a National Voting Act, just like we had a National Housing Act back in 1960. We need to nationalize this criminal justice system. And we need to acquire some national standards to prevent people from using this excuse to vent their racial hatred. Because this citizen's justice ties in with slavery. It ties in with the slave hunter. Well, they're part and parcel. I've done some tertiary research, and they both evolve around the same time. In this
absolutely,
country,
they do. So well, thank you. That was an eye opener. Thank you very much for contributing so meaningfully today. Richard from New Jersey, you are on the air. What do you, Richard Job? Oh, Richard, your call dropped, so you need to call back again. This is the question we're dealing with today. What have we been given as major hints as to where this case is going? Is it strictly about the trial? Or is there something else at work here? And what is that something else? And how will it affect an already bad and tense situation between people of color and the so-called law enforcement community that patrols them? Like in the old days, that's where the word patrol comes from, patterollers. The patterollers were the people sent into the bogs and the swamps to find runaway slaves. And, of course, to return them after receiving serious corporal punishment or getting killed on the spot with the report that, well, we don't know how he died, but we met him dead. Patterollers. The very word should send a chill up our spines. 888-874-4888. The trial is going on. Lots of activity in the courtroom. But I'm particularly concerned about what your reaction outside of the courtroom, noticing what the movement of this case and what has been brought to the attention of the nation as so-called important points. Where is this going? Are we talking here strictly about the trial of three men, a father, his son, and a neighbor? The neighbor was the one who did the filming of the atrocity. And where does that put us as a nation? And specifically, because we heard from Henry, the first caller today, that this is an issue of vigilante justice, and we have to look at it through what he called a racial lens. We can't ignore the racial lens. And as you look at it, what do you find as being very important here for us to keep tabs on? Because it's going to continue. The main points have to be developed now so that the conversation can continue on those lines after the trial is over. 888-874-4888. You're a little slow today. What's going on? You didn't have your Wheaties this morning? I like people on the ball. What do you see as the major points that have been made so far and will continue to be made as the trial goes along, for as long as the trial goes along? And how will the nation then deal with that? Let's look at some of the developments in this case and how people are reacting, even as the trial continues, to these points. And what importance do they place on these points? We just heard from Ed saying that we've got to pay attention. We've got to pay attention. Jeremiah from Harlem, you're on the air.
How's it going today, Trees?
Okay.
Always a pleasure to hear Ed. Ed is one of my favorite callers in general. But I was actually kind of surprised at the stance you were taking yesterday. While I was agreeing with most of your points, when you were saying that basically someone would be a fool to ever engage in some sort of citizens' action. But then it's like, don't we in general say it's a shame when people don't do anything to help their neighbors? You know, you see a person getting assaulted in broad daylight and all the people are bystanders and do nothing. And, you know, shouldn't we be looking out for each other as a community more rather than saying what you were saying yesterday, which is just, well, we have to wait for law enforcement and you're a fool if you try to intercede in any way. I mean, obviously, you can't go around trying to play hero, but people can help other people in different instances. And I also think it's a wrong idea to, you know, to be completely reliant on these agencies, police agencies, security agencies, as the totality of one's self-defense concept or community defense concept.
What I was saying was, it's not that I'm against people helping people, especially in a dire situation. This is a country predicated, and a lot of movement concerns the law, whatever the law is. And we still have no agreement exactly. That's what was one of Ed's points. We do not have a cogent definition of the law, including who is a citizen and who can perform a citizen's arrest. We don't have these things in place. So a person wanting to help may very well be putting him or herself in danger legally. And we need to have this discussion at a national determination of who is a citizen, who is considered a citizen, and who would have the right of citizens' arrests. What conditions must exist for a citizen's arrest to occur? And what are the potential damages a well-meaning citizen can incur to him or herself trying to do a citizen's arrest?
Yeah, I mean, these are very complicated issues, and I'm not saying that there's just some formula to resolve these philosophical issues, but I'll tell you a story quickly. For example, my brother, I practiced martial arts for most of my life, and my younger brother's also practiced martial arts for most of his life. And, you know, there's been various situations where thankfully and luckily we were able to use some of our martial arts training to diffuse situations. You can't, like I said, not a good idea to go around playing hero, because the real martial arts are that as soon as somebody has a weapon, all your fancy techniques and everything are out the window. All it takes is one slice, one shot, and your life is over. And you could be the toughest person in the world, the most skilled person in the world. But for example, my brother here in New York City saw a group of teenage girls jumping another teenage girl, and they were beating her up. And my brother, because he's a martial arts expert, could defuse the situation. Now, maybe other people could have jumped in there and they might have accidentally made a bad situation worse. They might have, you know, wound up committing assault against one of these girls. But my brother, being skilled, he can control people's wrists a little bit. He can do things without being overly forceful. He can use what we call the gentle art of jiu-jitsu and basically save a teenage girl from getting her, you know, the crap beaten out of her. And that's a good deed to me in society. And men should be trained, and women should be trained in self-defense. And we should also have community self-defense concepts that we can implement and develop.
Self-defense is one thing, but even jiu-jitsu can come under serious questioning by skilled lawyers who, in behalf of their clients, raise all kinds of questions. For example, you mentioned her hand. What if it was shown that her hand was severely sprained or broken? Who accepts responsibility for that? Is he insured? How is this going to work?
I mean, basically, in
having difficulty, the quality of your call here just deteriorated. Are you still there, Jeremiah? Oh, he fizzled out.
Hello.
Yes, I'm hearing you now.
Okay, sorry. This is live radio. Sorry, everybody. I'm literally on the streets in Harlem on my way to a friend's house, a musical collaborator. But I was going to say, in martial arts, basically, you can have stopping power with your hands and feet, meaning the ability to knock someone unconscious, and then you can submit someone with grappling techniques.
This is the United States. And people, there would be unscrupulous people hoping that something would happen like that, where they're in contact with a martial artist, and then they accuse a martial artist of doing injury to them. You see, this is very complicated.
What I'm trying to explain to you, Therese, is that my brother can assess a situation like that. Some situations might be far more dangerous, albeit. But in the situation I described, my brother knows he might get scratched, he might get slapped, but he's not going to be knocked unconscious by these young girls. He doesn't need to punch them and try to knock them unconscious or anything like that. He can restrain them. He's not going to twist their limbs in the opposite direction and cause something to sprain or break. He can evade. He can use his training in that situation and literally defuse the situation. Now, not every situation is that crazy, but some situations might be worse. You know, I mean, I've made a decision as a man. I'm not going to allow a child or an elderly person or a woman just to be assaulted in front of me. I have to brace myself and protect this individual if there's any chance to do so. And granted, if it's 100 and against one, then you might have to live to fight another day and really assess the situation and, again, not try to be a hero. But people can help other people is my main point for today.
But then you end up in a society. This is the society. This is how this society operates. whenever there's a chance to make some money, all kinds of things can go on that perhaps were never, ever true, but sound useful in an argument that they were true. And we have the other issue of where would a citizen fall in terms of hierarchy, because that would be a hierarchical situation, in terms of authority, as opposed to a law enforcement officer.
Right. Well, I think that law enforcement officers are elevated too highly in this hierarchy that you mentioned, because I think that they should be held responsible maybe to a higher standard in a lot of instances. They should be more aware of what lethal force consists of.
Yeah, should, but it probably will not happen as we expect it to. So these are the things that have to be dealt with. Should, therefore, a person in a position to come to the aid of someone, that person would be required to be self-insured?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not very knowledgeable when it comes to the whole insurance racket and how that whole thing...
That's what it is. It's a racket.
Sectors of society. But I also want to point to a quote from one of my political heroes, Pam Africa, who's pointed out at many a rally that I've attended that legal has never been synonymous with right. So I understand the purpose of the law. I'm not going to just proclaim myself to be an anarchist. I think there should be rules set in place in any situation for the safety of the community. But legal has never been synonymous with right. And we know quite well that the law has been manipulated, has been bent, twisted, disregarded, whatever needs to be done for certain verdicts to be reached or not reached. And this has happened so many times, whether it's in corporate law or regular old criminal law pertaining to events that happen on the streets and in neighborhoods.
So we see right away the cleavage here. If a particular issue would tend to affect people of color more so than whites in this society, it's an issue. If it isn't an issue, then soon enough, you'll see all kinds of rules and regulations popping up that must be obeyed. So this society makes it so difficult to gain traction on things that to many people are just logical. But look, we haven't even scratched the surface of this yet, and we're already into the mire of how is this supposed to work? Who is to be protected? Who is to have authority? And how do you get that authority? Do you take it? Is it given to you? Are you licensed for it? All these things we have to discuss. But thank you
so
much.
And in that respect, I just want to make it perfectly clear. The actions of the assailants in this case are completely indefensible. I don't put them in the
category
of vigilante or anything. I just think they're thugs. They're murderers. They're clearly racist. I don't think they would do that to a white person. I think
no, I don't think so either.
In the most vicious manifestation of murderous act. So, you know, I just wanted to. That was a separate question of community safety that I was raising. Not an abstract defense of these
murderers. And we saw that the system did not have a response for that. It
right.
did not
have
before,
on these
a
airwaves,
rationale for why they would behave that way. Who controls
no,
them?
And I've said on this program, and I think we should all repeat it and make it perfectly clear, when we see atrocities such as this being committed, and they're captured on video, we should all be very vigilant in not entering into any abstract discussions about this. The people who committed these heinous acts should be punished for what we have seen. We should not be engaged in a debate on whether or not we have seen what we have seen. We should just discuss saying it was Photoshop or CGI manipulation of what happened. That's not the legal argument. What we have seen was a murderous act, and the only discussion is how do we punish such an act, not whether or not we've seen what we've seen. And that's what we continue to be forced into, is this weird, you know, I fell and bumped my head kind of mentality of, wait, did I see what I just saw? Yes, you did see that. How do we punish that action? Not debate whether or not we've seen it, because we did.
I'm with you on that point. Thank you so much for your insightful contribution today. Marcus from Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Thank you very much, Utrice.
Thank you, Marcus.
I never take part in what I consider a spectator sport, ongoing commentary on jury trials, because people seem to suffer from the misconception that the jurisprudence laws are like the laws of chemistry or the laws of physics or something. It's some sort of immutable, irresistible law like the law of gravity. It is not. It's completely flexible. It's completely dependent on the interpretation of juries and judges, and always has been. By the way, although judges don't make this clear to juries, the jury is perfectly allowable to judge the law as well as judging the facts. This has been gone over a zillion times in the court system and in the constitutional law discussions. So the solution that if we get a national law that will somehow solve the problem, no, because the jury can say, no, this law is no good, so we're not going to pay any attention to it, and the decision they make stands. It has to. I would say the most significant development here in our country of guilty bystanders is the fact that the non-development, that there is no context for the trial or any of the other trials like it that you could point to in the last 30 years. What brought lynching to an end? It's taken a different form now. It's mostly police lynching. But, I mean, historically, beginning in, the late 1800s, you take a state like Georgia, in the 20-year period, I've researched this, in the 20-year period from, 1890 to, 1920, in that period, there were 400 lynchings in Georgia, the same in Louisiana, the same in, there were almost as many in Texas, almost all the southern states. It happened in Delaware, Oklahoma. This was common. And everybody understood that the purpose of lynching was well understood by both blacks and whites to be a warning to any uncowed blacks who were inclined to get out of line and not do so. Well, the laws you're dealing with in Georgia are built on that premise. Well, look at what it took. I've been researching a newspaper started by Ida B. Wells, who we're all supposed to worship during Black History Month, but nobody reads. She had a newspaper that in Memphis called the Free Speech and Headlights. And I've been reading all of them. And in an editorial, which is when the anti-lynching movement really got started, she's sort of responsible for beginning it. She wrote an editorial, and she was applauding some black people in Georgetown, Kentucky, who set fire to the town in revenge for a lynching. And she wrote that, I have a copy in front of me, and she said, some of the true spark of manhood was shown by their resentment. And she criticized blacks in Tennessee and Arkansas and Mississippi for not resisting lynchings publicly. She said, so long as we permit ourselves to be trampled upon, so long will we have to endure it? Not until the Negro rises in his might and takes a hand in resenting such cold-blooded murders. If he has to burn up whole towns, will a halt be called in wholesale lynching? Well, it took almost until 1930 before lynchings dropped below 5 a year. But that's what it took. There was a whole period in history known as the communal riot period, where in cities where black and white population was about equal, if whites started a lynching campaign, blacks took to the streets armed and fought them off. And burned cities if they have to. That's what it takes to actually make social change. The laws are a dead end. They can be interpreted by whatever the power system wants them to be interpreted as. So this idea that we can come up with some sort of a formula on paper that will protect people is just false. Historically, it does not work. It's obviously not working. The problem is that people, and I'm not just talking about this in the context, in this context. I think it's true in the labor context, all contexts. If people don't make it clear by their actions, by their deeds, not their words, what they are willing to do to gain their rights and anything you might want to imagine is justice, you won't have it. If you're going to appoint some hierarchical structure to do that work for you, you will be disappointed forever. That what I think is the significant development here. Whatever the outcome is, there will be the standard media furor about it, and ineffective demonstrations, people marching around and complaining will be, and then it will go back, then it will be over in a week, and you'll have another case just like it before the next month is out. And then we can start the process all over again. I don't know why people can't see through this. I really don't.
Well, there are reasons in that this system has organized many ways to protect itself against the people,
mm-hmm.
and to basically exact a price for rebellion.
Yeah.
And so people are not inclined to rebel. They're not inclined, even when it is to their advantage. It is in strict service of their interests to do so.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. They won't do it.
You asked someone last week. I'm sorry, go ahead. Pardon me.
So I'm asking, in this situation, what is there in fact a happy medium somewhere where things can start and gradually build, or is it something that has to be postponed until things arrive at a critical mass and it is assured that people are interested in taking action?
Well, I don't predict the future, but I would answer the question this way. You asked a caller a while back, I think it was last week, about what can we do that won't hurt people. And I thought to myself, you know, if we had done what we should have done, maybe back, you know, during the Nixon administration, you would have had lots of nonviolent options. Maybe during the Carter administration, maybe early in Reagan. But you've got a situation now where, one train car load of people control two-thirds of the wealth on the planet. They're going to inject your children with experimental pharmaceuticals. We're guinea pigs. That option, that nonviolent, peaceful, structural, hierarchical, representative option, is long gone, in my opinion. That's just an illusion. I think that's just making faces in the mirror, basically. It's a dead end. Completely. So, no, I don't think there are any easy answers for this, as there weren't, for instance, with black people in the early civil rights movement. Okay, you know, what were your options? Okay, well, I can keep my head down and, you know, hope my family doesn't get lynched or, you know, my house burned down. Or I can, you know, or I can hit the streets and organize with other people and probably get my head caved in by a cop, but I might win something for my children. Not nice choices, not at all. But people had to, they felt they had to act. And I think we're in the same situation, and that applies to the situation with labor and women's rights in any field you care to name. I just don't see any other option.
We have to leave it there. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Because we're out of time. But this conversation will continue because it is that important. Thank you very much, Marcus, for your deliberative presentation today. Thank you so much. Thank you all for contributing these thoughtful ideas that should provoke in us a chain reaction of thinking even more. We return to each other tomorrow and see what is out there in terms of what people are thinking. Thanks so much for calling in and listening today. Bye-bye.